Hey everybody, this is John Fusco, and you're listening to the No Film School Podcast. If you've seen any of Yorgos Lanthimos films, then you know the Greek director isn't afraid to put anything on the screen. Like many famous surrealists, Lanthimos isn't interested in exploring stories where things go right. He wants his audience to reflect on what's wrong in the world. To him, nothing is off-limits, and any dark side of the human psyche is worth exploring. In surreal films, any image can be too much or too little, and it's a delicate balance, but one that Lanthimos has truly mastered with his latest film, The Favorite. A period piece set in early 18th century England, a frail Queen Anne, in a magnificent performance by Olivia Colman, occupies the throne, and her close friend Lady Sarah, Rachel Weisz, governs the country in her stead. When a new servant, Abigail, played by Emma Stone, arrives, her charm endears her to the queen, and a competition to be the favorite emerges. In our interview, Lanthimos is joined by screenwriter Tony McNamara to discuss how commercial work early in his career ended up steering the director in the complete opposite direction, not conforming to filmic norms and breaking every possible rule you can. Hey everybody, this is John Fusco, and I'm really excited to have Yorgos Lanthimos and Tony McNamara with me today. Your latest film is The Favorite, but, I mean, you have one of my favorite, like, resumes, I guess, or rosters of films ever, because they're all so unique and so surreal, and I think, like, what I'd like to ask you first is, you know, I just watched Dogtooth again earlier this week, and we'll get to The Favorite, but how did you just, like, come right out of the gate making these kind of taboo films? Like, how are you able to do that as a young filmmaker, to just challenge the audience immediately as soon as you got to the scene?
Well, I guess, you know, one of the things where was, you know, what attracted me, you know, personally as a person, what, you know, what kind of films or literature or music I liked that obviously had an impact on me. Another thing I think is that I basically started by working in commercials a lot. So my first job, and where I learned all the technical aspect of filmmaking, is making for many years commercials. And because in Greece, you know, it wasn't, and it still isn't very difficult to make feature films, because there's no, you know, there's no real tradition or industry that supports it. It was kind of unthinkable that you'll make a career as a filmmaker of feature film. So I started by making hundreds of commercials, and when I, you know, reached the realization that I can, you know, despite that there's no support or infrastructure, that I can just, you know, make a film with my friends, you know, use the resources from commercials, production companies, and the money that we were making from commercials. I think it was just doing something that was exactly the opposite of what we're making while making commercials. So break every rule, like everything needs to be definitely not polished, no makeup, no hair, no lights, rough. Not necessarily narrative. It doesn't have to make sense. Just, you know, do everything against what we were making for years. So I think that's how I made my first film, Kineta, which very few people have seen, actually. And then I don't know. It's just, I continued from there on making things that I, you know, that felt the things that I wanted to make. I never felt that I had to succeed in, you know, as a filmmaker, because it wasn't really an option for me back then. It was just making films with my friends, so we were, you know, free to make them any way we wanted. Mm.
Were you ever putting any of your own voice into the commercial stuff that you would do? Like, was there any way for you to sneak in, like, some sort of the Yorgos we'd see later on down the road, or was that something that you really just, like, refined after making your first movie?
I mean, I guess it was very limited, you know, but still, even, you know, because it's a craft of some kind, you know, the choices you make, and, you know, visually or aesthetically or I think I used to have a, you know, an identity as a commercials director as well. It wasn't similar to my identity necessarily as a filmmaker, but obviously, you know, if you have some strong ideas and vision about things, I think it kind of goes for anything that you do. Mm. So in a very different way, I think I did have an identity while making commercials.
For the toolkit that you were sort of creating for yourself through, I guess, the commercials at first, but then like through the movies, what are your biggest tools in creating sort of these surreal worlds? What are the most useful tools for a filmmaker to create like sort of a surreal atmosphere?
I think, you know, there's something in every part of the process. There's, you know, from the inception of the idea, the initial idea is really important. How you materialize that into a screenplay, and then how you visualize that through, you know, filmmaking and performance with the actors and atmosphere, and then editing and sound and music, you know, everything. I guess it's not a very, maybe it's not a very useful answer, but I guess every part of the process is very, very important.
Is there a process that you find yourself sort of leaning towards more than any other? Like, is there one part that really interests you or excites you still to this day with each film?
Well, again, there's no one part of the process, but there's moments in each part of the process that, you know, are what feeds you in order to be able to continue. I think, you know, when you're thinking of something and you kind of get the idea and you get excited that this is something that can be really good, when you reach a draft of our screenplay that you start feeling confident that you're very near into starting pre-production, mm-hmm. that's very exciting. Pre-production pretty sucks because you know, there's so many, you know, difficulties and practicalities that you need to solve. But again, I think you do find, you know, the moments where, you know, you come up with ideas with your collaborators or you're rehearsing with the actors and it's fun. Mm-hmm. And then filming is extremely stressful because, you know, it is always about budget and time and how you're going to manage to get the things you want to get. And it's going to be like that forever and you can't return to it. And it's going to stay in history as you recorded it at this moment. Right. And the pressure is immense. So it's quite stressful, but you know, you do find yourself, you know, smiling and laughing sometimes with what you're seeing in front of you and what, you know, these adults are creating. And then again, you know, the editing I find quite a boring process. It's very long and boring. But again, you know, when you see something that didn't work and then all of a sudden by fiddling with it works.
Yeah.
Again, you know, there's an excitement. You find again your excitement.
I saw your film at the New York Film Festival about a month ago, and you told the audience in the Q&A after that there's these title cards that weren't initially in the plan for the movie, but that's something that you found in the edit, right?
Yeah. Well, I guess I felt that. The rhythm of the film was quite fast and things were moving really fast, which was a good thing. But at the same time, you know, I felt that I needed to have some pauses in a way that weren't long and be able to get people through a certain period to the next chapter. Mm-hmm. So I found, you know, that the titles were... The cards were an efficient way of doing that without having to spend a lot of time or coming up with different scenes. It was a matter of more punctuation for me, but also, you know, a humorous aspect of it, like using a line from the film, making it into a chapter. I guess it's quite a literary device in some ways.
Well, so you have written most of the screenplays of your movies yourself, but then for The Favorite, you had Tony. What was your collaboration like there? Why bring in a third party for this film in particular?
Well, I had a very specific, specific and non-specific idea about you know, what I was looking for this film. And although, you know, the original story was really interesting and the characters were very interesting and where it went and the resonance of the story, I knew very early on that we would have to bring someone else in order to accomplish what I had in my head. We went through a process, myself and the producers, of reading like hundreds of, you know, playwrights, screenwriters, any Anglophone writer that we could find. We ended up, you know, finding Tony, who's unfortunately not with us today. who was in Australia. That wasn't very convenient. His stuff, you know, seemed to already have, you know, that kind of voice. And although you can't describe it when you're looking for it, mm-hmm. you know, I felt very confident early on when I read his stuff that it was, you know, him that could actually pull this through. And then Tony, what's the rest of it?
The rest of it. Yes, the rest of it is I felt like it was really interesting. And I think we, as soon as we spoke, I felt like, you know, I went and watched, you know, I watched Dogtooth and I watched Alps, and I was like, as soon as we spoke, I felt like we understood. I sort of understood without, it's hard to put into words. It was like we sort of both knew, I could sort of sense what Yorgos wanted and what he was looking for, and we sort of both understood what sort of film we would try and write, you know, and make, and what it would feel like, and the tone of it in particular, and that we would turn it into a sort of different kind of period film, I suppose, and a tragicomedy. And so we did that, and it only took us 5 or 6, 7 years.
Have you really been in development? Was this movie in development?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like we were working consecutively years, but it did start. I mean, the first time I read the script, I think it was the original script, it was 2009.
Wow.
So I worked a little bit initially with the original writer, and then there was a period where we were looking for the next writer. Hmm. And then, I don't know, when did we start? I mean, it must have been like 6, 7 years.
I've got two more children than I had, so quite a while ago. But I think it was 6 or 7 years ago. But yeah, we weren't on it all the time because I was in Australia and Yorgos was here and he was making a lot. You know, then he would go make films and I would go and do other things. So we would always be sort of doing a draft or a pass, and we would Skype. You know, we would do Skypes and do notes, and I would do a pass, and occasionally I'd come to London for a little while, and we met in Rome for a week or so at one point. So we would just sort of do it randomly, I think, because I think at the time we knew it was a big film that would take a while to get right, but it would also take a while to get to the point where, you know, we could get the money to do it, I guess.
When I first saw the trailer or heard that you were doing a period piece like last year, I was like, oh my, this is such a left turn from like the things that I'd seen you do previously. And I already thought like maybe this would be something that could appeal to like a wider audience than maybe the one like the following that you had prior to this film. What would you say to, I guess, critics in particular who are like, this is your most quote-unquote palpable film to date?
Well, it might be. I mean, I don't know. I hope it is, because it's more expensive than the other ones. but again, I mean, I really never think that way when I'm, you know, choosing what I'm about to make. It's just things that interest me, things that challenge me, feeling that I'm doing something slightly different, feeling that I'm becoming better at certain things. And again, you know, I remind you, I read this 2009, so we started developing it back then, so it could have been the next film I made right after Dogtooth.
Yeah.
So that would be a left turn.
Yeah.
So it didn't really matter the fact that I made other films. I mean, I think I make the films when they're ready to be made, and when I feel the time is right, or the script is right, or you manage to put it together because of financing or because of casting. I mean, this another reason this took another year or so to make is because we sometimes had to wait for the cast, because I really felt it was very important to have the right actors for it, and when you know it didn't all fall into place as I wished it had, we had to push the film, and then I ended up making another film before. So it's you know many different reasons why you make a film when you make it, but it's for me it's certainly not a plan on making something which is you know more palatable and then something which isn't and then something which is or anything like that.
Well, then going back to some of the more like I guess taboo sort of imagery or filmmaking that you have done. I'm like a really big fan of when a director kind of provides us with like the ugly side of things rather than the beautiful. I think it's like a more engaging way to communicate with your audience, and it leaves them sort of thinking, you know, more critically or more engaged when they leave. Is that something that you like resonate with? Are you sort of fascinated in maybe screwing around with your audience a bit or?
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, people do ask me why I'm so pessimistic or my films are so dark. And,
well.
But I think, yes, it's because of what you're explaining. I don't think there's any, I'm not interested in making a film about things that go right, because what is there to say about it? I mean, it's okay, it's fine, it's going right. So why should I say something about it?
Yeah.
But then, you know, all of those things I find myself wanting to expose and wonder about and ask questions about is things that are not right, or things that I think we maybe think are right, but I think we should question. So I think that's how I'm driven to make the choices that I make.
Is there anything that you would be like, that you think would be too bold to put on screen, or is there anything you would be afraid to like show to an audience?
I don't know. I think it all depends in context.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, any image can be too much or too little or whatever.
Have you had any ideas for films where you've been like, oh, okay, wait, no, this is something that I can't actually follow through on?
Not really, because until you actually flesh it out and have a complete thing, you probably don't really know. I think anything is worth exploring, and if you feel that it feels right, you know, you go ahead and do it.
I've always been a fan also of the sort of like lenses and cameras that you choose to shoot on for your films, just the look. This movie is insane. Like the wide shots specifically with these like fisheye, sort of fisheye anamorphic lenses or something that you're using. What can you talk about what those lenses are and sort of the
Tony, tell us what those lenses are.
Well, they look to be made of glass.
They are made of glass and metal.
Excellent.
Well, it's just very wide. It's spherical lenses, but they're very wide.
They're like, how old are they? Where did they?
They're relatively old. Especially that really wide fisheye lens. It was something that was, you know, sitting on the shelves in Paramount. I'm gonna say Panavision.
Yeah.
For a while and. Because I had started experimenting with wide-angle lenses and movement, you know, for a couple of films now, and it's becoming my preference to do things in a certain way, but also push things further with every film. We tested wide-angle lenses. We felt it was appropriate for this film. You know, there was these huge spaces with these lonely figures in them that it, with the wide-angle lenses, that kind of feel was kind of enhanced. The distortion of that space, you know, the claustrophobic feeling that it provides you, seeing the entire space in one frame and seeing where it ends and not feeling that it's infinite.
Mm-hmm.
We found with Robbie this we were going for wide angle lenses, and I used up to the 10 millimeter while I was making the Killing of a Sacred Deer, and then we discovered this 6 millimeter lens, and we went like, oh, let's bring it, let's see what that does. And when I saw it and I saw the distortion, and I went like, I got really excited, but still. In the initial stage, we didn't even know that we were going to use it that much. We thought that it was going to be a lens that sometimes we would use, and then we would use the rest of them that look relatively more normal to our filmic language.
Right.
But you know, as we were using it, we just felt more and more intrigued by it, and tried to use it in different ways, and it just felt right for the film, and we kept using it more and more as we went on filming.
Anytime it popped up on screen, I just like audibly like gasped.
it is
insane.
There's an interesting 8 millimeter that we didn't use in the end, which was completely round. It creates a round image.
Wow. Sort of like a pinhole?
Yeah, like a pinhole kind of thing. It's a shame we didn't use it. Maybe on the next one.
I'd love to see that. So is that something that you...
Write it in the script, yeah. Tony. Then the next.
Are you guys...
Pinhole lens. Cut to
doing it today. I'll
pinhole
it
lens.
Are you guys working on anything together for the future currently? Or is this a partnership that it will keep producing work?
Don't say the title.
Okay. Can you say...
I won't.
No, I spoke...
Yes,
see
we
how
are.
Well we
yeah
communicate?
Yeah, your collaboration is insane.
Yes, we're working on something at the moment that something we think is going to be very interesting and funny and great.
And we'll have pinhole lenses.
Exactly, full of pinhole lenses and glass lenses. It's an adaptation of a book, and I won't tell you what book. Okay. But it's really, it's a sort of comedy, fantasy, very dark in lots of ways, and it's very, it's a really interesting kind of, I mean, we like it.
It sounds
funny.
Really, yeah.
Yeah.
And period, but not that period.
Okay, cool.
Period.
Well, I love
different period.
I love how you're exploring this period, so I would... Yeah, any more of that, keep it coming. So I guess we're almost out of time here, and I want to ask you both a question that I ask all my guests, which is, if you had one golden piece of advice for aspiring filmmakers, Yorgos, and aspiring screenwriters, Tony, what would it be? And why don't we start with Tony?
What would it be?
Careful, you have the future of people's young people's hands in your hand.
I know. I'm torn between go and saying be a lawyer or I would say just go and see a lot of theatre, go and see a lot of dance, read a lot of books, novels, and just watch an incredible amount of movies, because sometimes I feel like people don't do that. And I just... you have to be rich in a lot of different aspects of the arts to help inform your work. So it's not just, this is what I would say. It's not just like, I just know movies, I don't know anything else. I think you have to enrich yourself in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, you can really feel the influence of theater and dance and the historic novels in your film. How about you, Yorgos?
And yes, and so after you do all that Tony suggested, I'd say don't try to conform with anything. Don't try and fit in any box. Just, do what you feel is right for you. Just don't try and imitate anything. Don't try and succeed. Because I think only if you are genuine and you do, what is true to you and what you're interested in, that's how it can only go well. And that's how only you'll be content. And maybe you'll find, whatever kind of success is important for you.
All right, guys. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And everyone, definitely see The Favorite later this week. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and rate the No Film School podcast on iTunes or whatever podcast platform you use. I'm John Fusco. You can follow me on Twitter at @Jim_John_Jim. Go see The Favorite. It's in theaters now. And stay tuned later this week for Indie Film Weekly, our weekly news show. Until then, bye.